If you're not hearing security being talked about in your business, then you've probably got a gap. We see that more commonly than we'd like to admit.
This is KBCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
it's security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Mike Mengel, CTO and co-founder from CTO Labs, and today we're discussing strategic, secure, core engineering capability. So Mike, thanks for joining and welcome.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So I want to start with your version of strategic, secure, core engineering capability. What does this mean to you specifically?
Yeah, sure. So I'd probably like to break it down into those kind of two major component parts, which is around the strategic secure coding and then the engineering capability. If we start with secure engineering kind of first, what all of our engineers really are trying to do is they're trying to solve problems. That's what they're really good at. If you put the wrong problem in front of them, they'll probably solve the wrong problem that you're not really intended to, and they might end up doing some shadow IT stuff and things. But really, the goal here is put a solid problem in front of skilled problem solvers, and they'll solve it in an innovative, really interesting way. You balance that with a bit of the security lens, like there's a lot of security challenges that we need to do, and the problems that people are going to solve, they're going to use what they know in order to solve those problems. So they'll be familiar with certain frameworks, certain tools. Pretty much every organism in the world tries to kind of take the path of least resistance. So that's really a good thing. So it's about getting the right skill set in front of the right problem. And then the other part of the question is around the strategy side. Now, I am a really big fan of Simon Wardley. He creates these things called Wardley maps. And what he does is he kind of creates a map strategy. Now, in order for a strategy to be successful, he talks about a few different elements there. He talks about doctrine. You need leadership. You need a climate. You need to understand the environment, a landscape, all these other things. And while I won't dig in too much into the Wardley maps, one thing I really do like is he's got an example where he talks about observing a game of chess. And if you observe a game of chess and you watch someone do this amazing move, and then that move creates a really good outcome, if you took that chess move and just put it on a different map, on a different game with a different pieces in a different location, the environment and the landscape is different, would you expect the same outcome? Well, no, you wouldn't. But that's exactly what we tend to do when we don't really think of clear strategies. So I think the security is all about risk and controls, and you need to understand the landscape in order to do a really good job of that. So I think what I think of the strategic secure core engineering capability is really about this holistic approach to how to keep the crown jewels of your business safe.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there that you said which were quite interesting. You said don't put the wrong problem in front of them, meaning engineers. So would you say that people do this on purpose or accidentally? How does that sort of come around?
Yeah, it's definitely accidentally. I think part of this is the fact that not everyone is kind of aligned and in the right mind and understand the right mindset of what people have to go through in order to get a job done. Now, I've seen this a few times in large enterprises where, say, for instance, in order to get some cloud infrastructure, the engineers have to talk to IT ops, and IT ops, the way they talk to them is through a form that they have to fill in. And then they say, oh, I'd like a database and I'd like it to be this big, please. And that process doesn't really resonate with how engineers want to operate. They want to open a command line and they want to code, and they want to get things done really fast. So if you throw different bottlenecks and kind of red tape at a paid problem solver, they're going to solve that problem of the red tape, not of the thing that the business requirement. So in that case, what I've seen is people, you know, spin up their own AWS instances that are not secure and governed, and it just creates a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, you're right. And it absolutely does. And I think the other thing is, like, working a corporate background myself, like something that's so rudimentary could take so long to do. And then you've got to go through all these approvals. So from the employee angle, as in, you know, let's focus on maybe consumer angle, I understand that because there's so much rigmarole you got to go through and red tape, bureaucracy, corporate politics. So I kind of get it. But then if I switch to more of a security focus, it's sort of been the bane of our existence of trying to govern what everyone's doing. Of course, shadow OT starts to emerge due to the bureaucracy then around it. But you made an interesting point before, Mike, around moving pieces then on the chessboard, and then if you were to move those pieces onto another chessboard, is that sort of more like a framework to approaching problem solving from your point of view?
Yeah, that's 100%. So the way I think about this is, in order to understand a business, you need a business context. Now, what I do and what we do in C2 Labs is we break that business context into a few different parts. And really what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand the industry, the depth industry that the client operates in. We're trying to understand the drivers and the goals that they're trying to set, you know, the growth aspirations, the technology landscape they've got. Because if you're not developing mobile apps, you don't really need to care about the mobile app vulnerabilities, for instance. Now, all of that takes part of the business context. And what we then do is we then have a set of levers that we use in order to influence how we think about solving some of those problems. So for instance, if you're working on a very slow but appropriately moving platform. So for instance, you're managing mining, or you know, you're managing like an energy grid. You know, that doesn't need, you probably don't need to release five times a day like you do if you're Uber. So that kind of deployment frequency has actually a really strong play in the fact that you don't need to be that fast to market because you go through a quarterly release cycle or you know, various other kind of areas like that. So all of that kind of bakes into this business context to make sure that the risks that you're seeing and the controls you're trying to put in place are appropriate, really specifically appropriate to your business context. And that's exactly that chess move. If you look at somebody else and they're doing another business, you see they're doing something amazing, and you try and play that exact thing, that exact control, it may not operate in exactly the same way. And I think that's where experience of a broader set of industry and clients kind of really has massive benefit, because you get to see not only what worked, but also probably what didn't work. And then you can dive into the reasons why it didn't work.
Yeah, great points around breakdown business context. And I think it's something that, I mean, we all talk about in this space. Technical people speak one language, business people speak another, etc. I mean, it's sort of like, I don't know anything about building a house, and I could like, hey, Mike, I kind of want the thing to look like this type of house. But then you would need to come up with the context, and just give me an example, come up the context to the builders to say, this is how we're sort of going to engineer this. Because I think at the end of the day, what I sort of see is a lot of people saying, hey, I want this thing, but then not really understanding what's involved to make the thing happen. And maybe for someone who's an outsider who doesn't understand the complexity to it, how it works from the engineering point of view, that people think it's a lot easier to just build something from what they see on the surface. But when you start sort of going underneath it, there's a lot of stuff then going on. Would you often find, from your experience, Mike, that people just sort of point to something and say, hey, I want to like build the thing, it should take not that long, but then when you start digging into it and getting through the requirements, understanding the business context, that in fact, like, that thing that looks like 5 minutes work could actually be five months, you know, type of piece of work?
I can't tell you how many times that's happened. It happens all the time. And really, I think it comes down again to a bit of that experience to go, look, if you've implemented something once, you kind of have a bit more detail about it. Now, one thing that I quite like to do is I quite like to use this kind of 80-20 rule, which is obviously used a lot in different areas. But the way I like to use it is, on a new project, you only want to operate about 20% of innovation. And even then, that's quite a lot, because innovation is where the risk comes in terms of project delivery, and the experience is going to be gained on that project around building the thing. And I think the same thing comes down to when you're designing kind of security controls. If you're trying to be super innovative, then you're going to definitely introduce an element of risk in terms of the timelines, and the expertise in that you haven't quite got yet in order to implement those controls. So setting up tools and things, you know, if you've never used a tool, you'll probably get some, you know, configuration a bit missed.
Okay, so I want to press on this a little bit more, because this is really interesting. So I have built an application before. Now, I am not a developer. And one of the things I noticed whilst going through this project was I was probably sitting more in the middle side of it. So let's call it the engineers, me, and like the business side of it. What I found were, even the business trying to communicate to me what they wanted, I found it really hard. And then by the time it got to me, I had already lost, okay, call it like 30% of what they were trying to say. And then by the time it got to the devs, like, it was completely different. And then what I found was the business started to get more upset about how things were going and then started to blame the developers for not really understanding what they wanted. But it's like, yeah, but you're trying to explain something in your mind and not using terms that make sense. So how do people get more aligned on that? Because I understand from both points of views, like, you're not an engineer, so you're not going to use the right terminology. But then, of course, an engineer is not someone, you know, that can read people's minds either. So how do you bridge that gap between, this is kind of what I want as a business, but then also an engineer can't just click their fingers and they're, you know, going to produce something at the drop of a hat. So I think I've seen this happen so many times, and then there causes a lot of consternation between people and projects end up going south very quickly.
It's all about having the right roles in an overall project. Now, if you expect an engineer in order to be able to do the job of a business analyst or a technical analyst and a project manager and a marketing specialist and a UI designer, then there might be those rock stars out there, and I've probably met a couple of them, but they're few and far between. And certainly on larger projects, that creates too much responsibility and for one particular individual or a couple of individuals. So it's just about setting the team up for success to go, this is what you're going to be responsible for, and this is what you're not going to be responsible for. Because what we find is those technical analysts, they're very good at understanding. They're kind of the bridge between the product and, you know, the product vision, and then the engineer's skill set. Now, if you've got that bridge, then, and you understand both sides, they're better at communicating in a non-technical form, and better, so they can communicate up to the product people, but also they're really good at understanding, because they've run through this project many times, you know, the technical requirements, you know, a few different times. They're really good at then communicating that requirement down to the engineers. So when the engineers have a very fine-grained question, which would confuse a product owner, you know, like, where am I supposed to store this data field, or does this thing need to be encrypted? You know, then the technical analyst knows what that really means in the business sense and goes, right, what is the risk? And then they can communicate that up to the product and they can go, right, what is the risk of this field not being encrypted or not being hashed or you know, securely stored? And yeah, I think it's just about setting the expectation up front with the different types of roles. But yeah, I think we generally, as an industry, we expect the engineers to be the master of everything. And then, you know, kind of what's that phrase, you know, if you're the jack of all trades, master of none. We want engineers specifically to be really good at writing code. That's what they should be doing 90% of their day.
And you made a good point before around answering one specific question and then, like, okay, now that makes sense. Whereas a business person will probably come along and give all these sort of high-level thoughts, but then they need to sort of synthesize that information to be able to pass it down to, like, an engineer to say, okay, here, this is what the business has sort of said. There's technically 50 questions in this, and I need to get specific answers then from you. But then how do you go about, you mentioned before, you know, product owners, you've got marketing, you've got service owners, you've got, you know, PMO people in there, you've got all these people. How do you manage this whole too many cooks in the kitchen situation? Because again, the reason why people have like project sponsors is because it's one person then communicating that. But if that one person doesn't really understand the technical requirements, but then doesn't really understand the business, and then you have to bring in more people, but then bringing in more people then adds layers of complexity and then more room for errors. How do you manage that?
I think that the way I manage that is kind of like you manage the data flow. So for instance, I've worked on teams where automated testing is a really good practice, and it's an absolute default in the software industry nowadays. Now, what businesses used to do and teams used to do a little while ago was they would put that as a task and say, oh, automated testing is something we do after we've built the feature. Now, the downside to that is that task is invisible by people who don't understand the benefits of why automated testing is a really good thing and should be an absolute default. So what I always coach those teams on is that's an implementation detail that you don't need to expose outside of your control. So you know, you, in the same way that you wouldn't tell a product owner that the lines of functions that you're going to write are based on a framework or a library that you're using, it's just too detailed. I think that there's an element of those implementation details around this, you know, again, the testing or the security aspects of how you would build something, which actually doesn't really need to be published any higher. You know, we have an agreement with the business that we're going to build something to a certain quality, to a certain delivery timeline. That the quality is is security and testing and performance and scalability and all of that stuff baked in. And that's why, you know, you hire these experts in who can build software really, really well. And then you hire the product people who understand the domain really well, and they understand, you know, what the minimal viable product needs to be in order to get, you know, market traction and all that stuff. The engineers don't need to understand that to a certain degree. So I think it's about creating those boundaries that just go, this is outside of your area of expertise. We've got this. Almost like leave us alone, but in a nice way.
Yeah, you make a great point. And I think the be all and all answer to this is it's hard. There's no real like silver bullet, as they say, way to do these things. Because again, you've got different people's experience. You've got different personalities in there. You've got different egos, which then creates that layer of complexity of managing these people's expectations. So I just want to make a caveat there that like all of these things are hard to do. And again, this is just an opinion, and it's just talking to yourself, Mike, to understand more about your experience and how to go about some of these challenges that do exist in our space. So I want to press on now, and you've made a statement, which I'm going to read out, and then I want you to sort of talk me through your thinking behind this. So the statement was, a fast-moving and productive software development lifecycle, it is as important to enterprise security as a well-functioning circulatory system is to the human body. So I'm really keen to understand your thinking behind this statement.
It probably comes from theory of constraints. And I wouldn't say I'm an expert, but you know, I've read a few books on the thing. But really, it's about flow through a system. Now, if you step back from the fact where, you know, most of the engineers are just kind of writing code, you kind of step back and you go, right, well, what's the end-to-end flow for this thing? It's got to get budgetary sign-off. It's got to go through an ideation phase. It's got to be built. It's got to be qualified, you know, verified. It's got to be packaged. It's got to be deployed. It's got to be supported. And I think at all those stages, then what we need to do is we need to be able to identify the bottlenecks in that system and the handoffs between teams. And you know, if you get that right, then you're kind of optimizing for flow through a system. Now, there's certain agile practices, things like Kanban, that really kind of talk about cycle time and really try and identify that flow through a system. Sprint and Agile and general Agile does a fairly good job as well, but it doesn't always take into account some of the things outside of the development phase. But I think that if you consider three different kind of business archetypes, the startup, the scale-up, and the enterprise, the startup, they have very little red tape. They pretty much just sign up for whatever they want. They have very low governance normally. Now, to operate flow in that environment is really, really easy. It's generally a small team. They're all aligned, and they just, you know, they kind of flow stuff out the door. Now, contrast that to an enterprise business. Now, an enterprise could have, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees. And the governance and security especially is super important, and kind of risk, you know, risk management is super important in those large organizations. So they often have that creates a bottleneck in the system, because for instance, you might have an architecture review board who need to review a custom bit of software being built. Now that architecture review board, maybe it meets every two weeks, every month. So you've got to wait. You're kind of waiting for your design to be approved. And then that, you know, maybe hopefully it gets approved in that session. And then once it's approved, maybe it goes into the ISO team. So they, you know, like look at the security risk of the decision of the architecture that's being proposed. Again, that's another bottleneck. It gets handed off to another team. So what we've done, and like it's worked really well in some businesses, is we map out that flow. We understand where those bottlenecks and those kind of slowdowns are. And really, it's about inter-team communication. That's really the crux of this. Different teams have different sets of priorities. Now, you can be largely aligned to a goal of a business to grow the business by 30% in a year, or whatever those goals are. But every team has a set of priorities, and you as an external member to that team, your task normally goes into the bottom of their queue. So what we do is I've kind of mapped this process out before. You know, you look at how long something stays in kind of a waiting state in each team or in each part of the process. And then what you do is you try and work out how you can automate that process. So what's worked really, really well, and ended up building a set of tooling, which kind of talks to what we mentioned before around the engineers solving the problem we're getting them to solve the right problem. Imagine that we've got, oh, actually, I'll tell you, this exact client. Well, one thing that they did was they the security team, they would look at an architecture and then they would build it in a test environment. And then they would run this tool over it. This tool was called Cloud Conformity. And what this tool does is you kind of point it at some cloud infrastructure, and then it kind of downloads the blueprints and then runs some tooling over it in rule sets to go, is it secure? Has it got the right controls in place? For instance, is your database encrypted? You know, it's pretty standard stuff, but engineers may miss that because they're not the security specialists. So the security specialists are all co-located in this one security team, and they've got all the skills, but they've got a kind of a scale challenge. So what we did was we took those rule sets and we took those architectures that did pass the cloud conformity rules, and we baked that into a set of templates that the engineers could easily leverage. So now what those engineers can do is they can say, oh, I need a new database. And then they open a command line, which is, you know, like the terminal and, you know, just the way that engineers really like to kind of start off on the coding journey. And then they can just basically type a couple of lines and they can go, make me a new project. I want a database template, please. And then it goes off and pulls down that template, which is security approved. It's gone through the architecture review board. It's a component in a larger system, but that component is completely conformant, or it complies to whatever rule set that the client's chosen. And then what they can do with that is they can then get that into deployment, because we also kind of mapped out the whole deployment process and automated that. So now what happens is this particular client manages to deploy software or deploy infrastructure. What used to take up to 6 weeks, they can do it in 4 minutes, because we just automated the hell out of it, really. And yeah, and so this whole kind of, you know, tying it back to the circulatory system thing is really about, you want to just identify and remove those blockages, which is a common understanding, but it's the nuance of doing that is really difficult sometimes. And I think if you connect that to the psychology of the people who are trying to get to solve the problem, then you end up putting something in place that fits them and doesn't necessarily, you know, you might not have got to that design by not really understanding the end user. And in this case, the end user is internal people to the business, you know, engineers and, yeah, teams who need to build software.
Okay, so there's a couple of things in there I want to ask you about. You said the thing that we do is we map it out. So give me an example. So we can tell you map it out. So you get in a room with everyone, you map it out in a whiteboard first, and then it sort of transfers to more of a digital version of it. What does that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. The you know, in the post-COVID days, we would always get in a room. Sometimes we have to do it virtually nowadays. But yeah, basically, you just get a big whiteboard, and then you can do what's called a user journey map. Now, the user journey map often is used in more user experience, kind of, you know, front-end design things, but you can actually apply that to internal business processes. So what you do is you understand all the actors who play a part, all the different teams, and then you want to follow the bouncing ball. So if the scope of what you're trying to identify the flow of is getting a piece of code into production, for instance, then you just kind of walk through every single step and you go, right, now that we've written the code, what happens next? Okay, now the QA team, the quality assessor, the quality analysts, they get hold of it and then they have to verify it. Okay, so what does that look like? And you map out all this stuff. And what happens is, in these systems of flow, you end up having two different kind of columns of activities. You have a column which is a waiting column, which is you're sat in a queue, basically. There's only so many things that this one, say, quality engineer can check at the time. So sometimes your stuff will hold in a queue. So you have a queue column, and then you kind of have an action column, like a doing column or an in-progress column. And that's when somebody can take something off the backlog of the queue and go, right, I can now work on this. And all you're trying to do in this system is kind of really map it out and go, well, what's the average wait time in each of these areas? Where should I invest my time in order to optimize this process? And then once you've got that overall map, you kind of work out where the start and end is of it. And then you can identify the biggest benefits. And if there is a particular element in this flow or particular part of this process that things are waiting for 2 weeks, you know, and that's the biggest wait time that you've got in the whole overall flow, then that's where you want to focus your effort. And how do we get that 2 weeks down? How do we provide better information so they can progress more tickets at the same time or faster? Or is there a way of automating an element of that? So then that 2 weeks, you know, if each task is taking somebody 3 or 4 days of manual effort, can we get that down to a few hours? And, you know, you kind of shift left the design and the automation a little bit. I probably say automation a bit too much, but I really believe in it. I get bored with doing manual things over and over again. So for me, the I kind of have a bit of a goal, which is, you know, if I do something once, then fair enough, it's a manual process. If I do it twice, I might mark it and go, oh, this might have an opportunity to be automated. And if I have to do exactly the same thing a third time, it's time to automate, you know, to a degree. Depends on how long it'll take to do that level of automation. But yeah, just try and, you've only got so many keystrokes until you die, unfortunately. So I want to make them really valuable and spend as much time doing like the more valuable stuff as I possibly
Absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely. I'm totally on board with that approach as well. So, okay, I know it sounds like I'm harping on a lot about this, but I think these things are so important, and it's these small nuanced things that I think people just don't get right. So I just want to focus then again on, you said typically you know where the slowdowns are and where the bottlenecks are. So do you sort of illuminate on your map of this is typically where we have slowdowns, because you said it's going to go through all these approvals and it's going to go to some advisory board, then by the time it gets back and then the main guy's gone on leave for 4 weeks. Do you identify that up front? And I'm assuming that you probably see a correlation between projects that you've done before.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. So if you can get real data points on this, there's a lot of what I quite like to do is kind of put a little confidence factor in there to go, look, if it's an observational, I think it's going to take 2 weeks in order to get this thing done, then that's okay, but your confidence is a little bit lower. If somebody's actually measuring this and it goes, look, we can look at the last 10 actions and we can average those out based and categorize them based on size or whatever and go, it takes an average of 3 days. That's a really strong data point. So I think that kind of leans into the model that we're trying to build. But yeah, exactly. We're just trying to build a really good representation of a flow through a system that we can really believe, and then we can start to make those changes too.
Do you think then that gives the business or everyone on the project gives them assurance then to be like, okay, we know what's going on. We typically, I mean, look, there's obviously going to be things that go awry during any project. I understand that, and there's contingency. But by doing this gives everyone involved in a project that assurance to, okay, we sort of know at a high level what's happening. We sort of know as a rule of thumb where the slowdowns are and where the bottlenecks are. Do you think overall that then provides a better outcome then for a project? And would you say that people who fail to do this probably are running projects a lot slower, et cetera?
The awareness of scope and the alignment, I think that's probably the right way to kind of call it. Now, each team is obviously trying to do the best they can in their with their known environment and their known kind of climate and, you know, what they know about the goals. But there's often a bit of an alignment gap in between teams. So this is the inner team versus inter-team kind of challenges. When it's an inter-team problem that you're trying to solve, the individual team that you're trying to optimize here might not understand how they fit into the overall ecosystem of this kind of process flow. And I've seen that quite a few times as well, where they, as far as they're concerned, they're delivering the best service they can. They're as efficient as they can. But no one has ever, this happens more often than I'd like to probably admit, but no one has ever mapped out the entire process and said, you're part of this large, you know, you're cogging the wheel, which they understand. But if you optimize this part of your cog, then we'll actually, you know, increase revenue by an extra 3% because we have this extra flow going through. And that sort of understanding, I've been in rooms where once we've mapped this out, the people in the room who are representing those teams, the penny kind of drops for them and they go, oh, right, okay, so I shouldn't be pushing against a particular part of this process because I'm part of it. And if they understand where they fit in that process and just how smooth the business could operate and how great we could be achieving those business goals, then they understand where they fit in the whole machine. And I think that's just so incredibly valuable, because when you have an awareness like that, then you break down some barriers of how you want to operate, and you can end up being open to learning from different teams and how they like what could be best for you if you could talk to a team further upstream of the process and go, look, if you just added this tweak to your process, then our process could be sped up by 3 times. But often that communication between inter teams just doesn't happen very often in the larger organizations.
Absolutely, because there's so many people then involved, and it goes back to that too many cooks scenario. So what do you do, Mike, from your experience? Just so hypothetically, you've mapped something out, you're like, okay, here's a bottleneck, just say arbitrary numbers, it's a 4-week bottleneck. What happens when it gets to 8 weeks? Do you find that people come back and say, well, Mike, I thought you said 4 weeks, now it's 8, now it's going to be 12. How do you handle those scenarios?
all of this is about, unless it's a very strict manufacturing style, really predictable process, there is going to be peaks and troughs. And what all we're trying to do in this workshop and in this process is identify the general bottleneck in the system. We're not trying to, if something goes from we estimated it as 2 weeks because that's the data we had, and suddenly something's 8 weeks, it doesn't. It kind of matters, but it kind of doesn't really matter. The process here is really just about identifying the scale of those problems within a system, and then knowing that investment in those areas would be best placed. So if you've got, I don't know, say 10 steps in this process, and one of them is really, really messy, but it's going to cost a decent amount of money or time in order to solve, like, it would be better for everyone holistically in the whole process to lend a hand, or maybe even transfer some budget into this slow moving part, and then the overall system operates faster.
Yeah, totally hear what you're saying. It's just I've just worked with people before that are quite specific and attentive on the timelines on things, and so again goes back to managing difficult personalities, and it comes back to understanding the context. It may seem that what they're looking at may appear in their eyes 2 weeks, but it could be 2 months. And then trying to explain to them why it's taking longer, or why that one step could take 2 months, sometimes is hard. But then I guess it comes back to everyone on the same page, understanding this is the flow, this is how things are going to go. Would you say, in your experience, Mike, people who are not doing this step, because again, in a perfect world, what you're saying makes total sense. Again, some people are not doing this. People that there's frustration, consternation between teams, upset stakeholders. Why would people forgo all the steps that you've mentioned?
Partly it's because of an experience thing. They might not be aware of exactly how some of this stuff could work. A lot of businesses that I've kind of seen, and my business sees, is they've never done a user journey map or any sort of system flow diagram. They're either very heavy on the business and what's going to drive the business forward, but they don't have some of the tools in order to kind of do this sort of mapping.
So for people who are sitting here listening to what you're saying, because what you're saying makes total sense, I like that you've given specific examples as well, because I like people from the show to get tangible advice. How do people sort of start with the user journey? Like, what should they start doing now immediately to make sure that they are not having as many problems with their project? Is there anything you can sort of recommend?
Yeah, I'd say that they should probably start by just mapping out their own process first. So user journey maps and system flow diagrams are you could Google those and you could get some really good examples. And I like to get inspired by those examples and then tailor them to like my needs. But if you start by mapping the thing that you really know, and then all you need to do is, if you kind of imagine that's the bit that you're in control of, and then kind of go, well, let's go upstream a little bit and go, well, what happens before this? This kind of process starts. Who do we get our information from, or what's just left of it? And then go to that team and show them your diagram and go, look, we want to help you build out this model. And then they enhance it. And then all you're really doing is you're just kind of pushing the end to end of this. You're pushing the head and the tail of this diagram just ever so slightly out and out and out. And then you'll end up optimizing for flow and kind of making decisions on how to improve that process, even inside your team before you even go external. And then you can then talk to the business about the benefits and say, well, we've actually invested 10% of our effort in optimizing this particular part of our flow, and that has made us as a team be more successful. Our output has increased. And then you kind of branch that out a little bit further. You kind of go a little bit backwards in the process, a little bit forwards in the process, to make sure that the people the inter-team communication and kind of part of the process that you've got is as fluid and as kind of optimized as it can be. And then every time you step a bit further out, you'll learn something more about that part of the process that flows into yours, that if you optimized yours, something downstream or upstream would be beneficial.
So I want to understand now from you, Mike, is that people often talk about secure software development, but perhaps there's still a gap, which we've clearly spoken about at length today. But then how do you sort of get this right, and how to do it properly? Because again, I like to be very practical to these sort of approaches as well. In theory, we can talk about theories all day. It's been written in a book, but we can't do basic things in this space, right, that have been written in books after 20 plus years. So I'm just really curious. You've obviously got a lot of experience. You're very practical. You're very pragmatic towards these problems. What would be your recommendation to closing that gap?
Well, you need to understand how big the gap is first, I think. The gap is pretty vast, unfortunately, at least in the security specialist kind of side of this. I know that Cyber Ventures did a study last year, and I think they've done a refresh of this year, where there's about 3 million open roles in the security specialist kind of set of jobs globally. And unfortunately for us, there's about 2 million of those in APAC alone. So really, there's a lot of open roles. They found that it can take 3 to 6 months to find a really good suitable candidate, which means that you can't solve that problem overnight. So you have to be, and the way I think about it is you have to be tactical and you also have to be strategic. Now, the tactical thing right in front of you as a business owner or as a leader in a business is probably you've got something maybe even is close to being on fire that you need to resolve. Now, how do we solve that problem? The tactical thing is you just need to get someone in as fast as possible. And, you know, I've worked with really good vendors and, you know, other kind of consultants who are really good at that space. But then the strategy play is there's just so many open roles. This problem can't be solved overnight. So having a strategic solution to this for me is something like playing the long game a little bit. So knowing that you can't solve this problem in a few months, especially if it takes up to six months just to find one person. So it's a multi-year kind of problem to solve. And if you solve that problem kind of upfront, what you can do is there's a couple of different ways I like to think about this. You can either go internal or external. Now, the opportunity for internal is that you might find someone who is, or what I found is that you find a set of roles that could be transferred into the security space really well. So there's a diversification of job role. Now, what those roles are is, you know, network engineers make pretty good security people generally, system ops people, engineers. If you're deciding on where you need that security specialist, maybe it's in the AppSec space, so application security, you know, software development lifecycle, you know, built securely, that sort of thing. Then an engineer and finding an engineer inside the business already who has an interest in security, and you can ignite that into being a passion. That is absolutely worth its weight in gold, because what you can do is you can do things like you can pull together a guild of people. Now, guild, not really in the Spotify model, but just a way of kind of grouping people with a similar interest together. And then, you know, as what I do is I'll monitor those kind of channels and those meetups internally to see who looks like to be a good candidate. And then what I might do is I might throw them towards some security training and just see how that resonates. Now, that means that we've got this possible, depending on the side of the business, obviously, we've got this possible internal set of sources of resources that we could turn into what we're looking for. That's a slightly slower play than just going out to market and finding someone. But what you find there is the cultural and kind of social benefit for an individual. Because I like to think of the actual humans who are in the business. Like that human who you have invested your time in is going to be more invested in the business because, you know, you've given them an opportunity that they wouldn't have maybe even realized that they wanted. And I think that that's really important to get to know those individuals and those humans. Now, on that same breath, if you look externally, the type of psychology of someone who you're looking for is not just a problem solver, but they, you know, there's kind of a bit of a nuance to these security engineers or the security specialists. And what we find is that the benefits package or the employee value proposition that you might have as a business for generally all of your employees just might not fit with those individuals, security specialists. Now, for instance, if you understand the motivation of what that one individual that you're trying to kind of pull into the business, what their motivation is and their benefit that they're really looking for, it might be working from home 100% of the time is the thing that this individual just absolutely resonates with. And to be honest, with a lot of engineers, it is in that play, personal preference, but I think it's a mix that you need to build relationships, and those relationships are built more strongly in the time in between meetings, which really only happens when you're physically located. But what you can do with that benefits package is you can actually cut out some of the stuff that this individual just does not care about and index on the stuff that they do care about. And that's the kind of the human element into bringing people into the business. Some options that you can do to find some of those people. I quite like GitHub's API is really powerful, and you can actually very straightforwardly, probably using OpenAI, to craft some basic code, but you can query that API, search for people who are in a particular location. They are contributing to an open source project that you're either using internally or, you know, you're quite interested in. And then you can kind of go direct to those individuals. And we've used that a few times, and it does actually give you quite interesting results. And then I suppose just to dovetail us into that as well, not every engineer contributes to open source software. So what do you do when you're kind of coming against those individuals? There's a term that Scott Hanselman, who is a principal project manager at Microsoft, he's really good and he's really quite outspoken, and he's been helping Microsoft move into a more positive space in terms of open source community. He talks about dark matter developers. And these are the people who are not contributing openly to open source projects, that we know they exist because they're the bulk of who are filling those job roles. You know, there's maybe 3 million open roles, but there's a lot more filled roles, and not everyone has the time or the inclination in order to contribute to open source libraries. So how do you find those? And it's really about those relationships. So it's the people, it's the kind of the friends of friends thing that we kind of can leverage. So there's really strong referral opportunities in there. And I kind of also think that those dark matter developers can be turned into open source contributors with a bit of coaching. And one of the kind of, I feel like I'm going on a bit more of a tangent, but one of the ways I like to talk about this is, like, you are not your code. As an engineer, I have written so much code. And a large portion of that, I could probably write better now because I've learned things since I wrote that code. Now, if you create that emotional disconnection between the code that you write and who you are and who you identify as, then it means that when you're more likely to put something in the open source community because you're not worried about getting constructive criticism or even criticism. Because, yeah, it was the first time you wrote that code or the second time. And of course, things have moved on. There's better tooling. You know, there's ways of writing that code better. So I think there's a bunch of stuff there. Probably the only extra thing I'd mention is Team Code Forensics. Now, Code Forensics is a super, super powerful tool that you can run on internal code bases. And what you can pull out from that is you can pull out things like knowledge silos. You can pull out overall health of a project and a code base and to go, oh, you know, we're trending downward in terms of quality based on some contributions and various things. But what you can also do with that is you can identify individuals in a team who are starting to pull away from the main group. So you can identify just purely on a really measured, on a really kind of data-led decision kind of framework. You can point these tools at your code bases and you can go, well, this one individual over the last 3 months, they seem to be contributing to only one part of the code base that no one else has an area towards. They seem to be, from the data is indicating that they're kind of branching away from the main group. And as a leader, as a people leader and as a team leader, what you can do with that information is you can start to fold them back into the group a little bit more. Now, solving those problems means that you won't have kind of team challenges in the future or as many team challenges in the future because you're able to really see what's not quite going well and you can adjust and improve. Yeah, there's probably a bunch of other stuff, but they're kind of the main bits. I absolutely love roadmaps.sh. It's an open source, it's a website, roadmaps.sh, but it's an open source community who have built a set of roadmaps in order to get to kind of expert level on various different things. If you want to understand how to do software architecture, or if you want to learn how to be a front-end engineer or a DevOps specialist, they've recently released a cybersecurity specialist one. Now, what this roadmap does is it tells you, it kind of gives you a little indication, what is the ecosystem and what is the landscape you need to start learning in? And then what you can do with that is you can then start to understand where your interests lie. And it gives you a bit of a, not only does it give you the topics and areas of what a security specialist needs to know, but also gives you video tutorials and kind of point you towards open source community, open source contributions to go, this is a really good blog post on this particular topic, or this is a really good video or training course. I find those super valuable and I use those all the time for career development for the people I manage.
Never apologize for a tangent because I love a tangent. I love people to go off topic or whatever it is because, again, that's what gets a raw interview. That's what gets the real point of view. Roadmaps.sh, we'll make sure we put that in the show notes for people wanting to know more about that. Just a last sort of question for you, Mike, before we conclude would be, you mentioned before, like, sitting in some of these guilds that, you know, there are certain people that perhaps might be a more appealing candidate. Is there any sort of levers that you sort of focus on? Like, maybe is it someone asking more questions? Like, what is it specifically that you're like, oh, that person seems like a potential candidate that might want to move into the security space? Is there anything that sort of stands out for you?
There's a chap I quite liked on the interview process, kind of thought leadership piece. His name's Joel Spolsky. He used to work on the Excel team at Microsoft years ago. He says in an interview, you only have enough time to do two things. All you've got time to do is go, is this person smart and do they get things done? I quite like that as a general guide, but I think over the years I've probably enhanced that a little bit into going, are they energy giving or energy taking? And that's another kind of element that I quite like to use. If they're energy giving, then the conversation is flowing, you know, then, and you've, as an interviewer and kind of finding those people to invest in, it's about igniting that passion. Now, if you can mentor them in that space, you don't need to be the expert in order to mentor. That's a different size kind of skill set, but you can guide someone into creating, understanding who they are a bit more in their passion.
Well, I think that's excellent. And I think that, again, I really appreciate you handling my relentless questioning on things. I mean, look, devil is always in the detail in these interviews. And again, like really asking the guests for those answers and feeling like I'm repeating the question, I think is where a lot of tangible advice sort of is derived from. So is there anything specific you'd like to leave our audience with today, Mark? Any closing comments or final thoughts?
In my business, we operate quite a lot with the like C-level execs and board members and things. And I think for those listeners in that sort of space, if someone in your business, if you're not hearing security being talked about in your business, then you've probably got a gap. We see that more commonly than we'd like to admit in kind of the assessments and in the processes that we do. One way of kind of testing this is ask to see a risk register or a threat assessment. If those haven't been done on your business, then you probably want to investigate that. But other than that, I think that's really the kind of the last thing I'd kind of say, other than, you know, I always find that security is a bit like compounded interest. You know, the earlier you start just doing something, then that compounds into a much kind of higher quality in terms of security over the years. And this is, security is very much a long game. So I think the compounded interest analogy works quite well.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.